I'm Diosa.
And I'm Mala.
We're the creators of Locatora Radio, a radiophonic novela, which is a fancy way of saying
a podcast. Welcome to Locatora Radio Season 9.
Love at first listen.
This season, we're falling in love with podcasting all over again.
With new segments, correspondence, and a new sound.
Listen to Locatora Radio as part of the Michael Dura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
More Than a Movie is back with Season 2. I'm your host, Alex Fumero. And each week, I'm going to talk to the people behind your favorite movies. From The Godfather, Andy Garcia.
He has the smarts of Vito, the temper of Sonny, the warmth of Fredo, and the coldness of Michael.
To the legend behind La Bamba, Lou Diamond Phillips.
When I walked in, I didn't think I had a shot at Richie because John Stamos's picture was already up on the wall.
Listen to More Than a Movie on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Michael Rappaport.
And I'm Kibi Rappaport.
And together we're hosting Rappaport's Reality Podcast.
We have a passion for reality TV, and we're inviting you into our living room.
We're dissecting the drama, and we're giving praise to the single greatest form of entertainment on television today. That is right. Reality TV is the greatest form of entertainment on television today. Listen to Rappaport's Reality starting May 8th on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
KFI AM 640. You're listening to the John and Ken Show on demand on the iHeartRadio app.
There's been new stories concerning the Antifa activists, Antifa standing for anti-fascist. So we're going to talk now to a man that actually, well, he was once a part of the Antifa movement. In fact, he wrote a book, Behind the Black Mask, My Time as an Antifa Activist.
Gabrielle Nadales is on with us. Gabrielle, welcome.
Thank you for having me on.
It's good to have you on here. I find this fascinating, and I very much want to read your book. Let's start, because we do have limited time. What was your road to becoming sympathetic to joining Antifa?
So the best way to really understand Antifa is to make sure that you distinguish it from the original one. The original one comes from the 1940s, and it kind of died out after World War II, with the exception of anarchist groups here and there all throughout the world, right? But in the 1980s, the anti-racist action in America and the parallel of the Antifa movement in the UK started being formed. And they did quite a few different things. They would tour around with punk bands, which is music groups, to go beat up Nazis and skinheads, right? But in the 1990s, the WTO protests happened, and there began to be a solidarity among anarchist and left-wing and radical left-wing groups.
And the WTO protests, that was the World Trade Organization.
That was up in Seattle, as I remember.
1999.
Right?
That is correct. And then from there, there seems to be the solidarity. And in 2007, the first anti-racist action chapter changed its name to the Rose City Antifa, which is the one in Portland. That's been continuously active since 2007. And then a lot of these anti-racist action chapters changed themselves to Antifa, calling themselves Antifa, or variations of that name. And in 2011, when I first joined, I loved punk music. So I knew a lot about the history about Antifa, the W2 protests, all of that. So I wanted to get involved. I was already an activist. I just showed up to a protest where I thought Antifa was going to be. I dressed in all black, and lo and behold, they recruited me into the movement.
And what were some of your first actions with the group?
So the first time I ever put on that black mask where I knew absolutely no one, it was actually to protest the National Socialist Movement in Claremont, California. This is in March of 2011. And I knew that there was going to be actual neo-Nazis there, so I figured Antifa was going to show up. That's the first time I ever did anything, but it was really much.
Were you actually fearful of Nazis spreading across America, or you were more interested in fighting something, anything?
Well, I definitely think I saw that there was a lot of issues out there that I wanted to fight for. And when I found out that the National Socialist Movement, which is an actual movement that deserves a lot of shame, was actually going to do a march in my community or like 2-3 cities from where I lived, I decided to just show up. And, you know, from there on, they invited me to a lot of different things all throughout Southern California, whether it be animal rights protests, anarchist book fairs, or the Occupy protests in general. They were very big at the time. I put on the black mask several different times.
Did you engage in any violent acts of any kind? Or
so I'm lucky that, you know, I was 17 at the time. I was definitely not one of the more violent persons by any means and stuff. I never got into a fight or altercation. But I do remember in Pomona, California, again, in 2011, I put on the black mask and I was trying to break down a door at a courthouse. There's actually a video of this, and I've showed it around on YouTube. You can't tell it's me, obviously, because I'm wearing all black and all that. But I remember that the police came, and there was a horse-mounted police officer, an officer on horse mount, and he started dispersing us, and I started to run away. That's kind of more of extreme version of things that I did.
After you spend months and months doing this, what did you think you were accomplishing?
You know, it's about what we believe is that it's all about incremental values. It's about showing up or putting our face out there and making it seem that, you know, we're actually doing something. It's all about getting more and more people, and hopefully we make some sort of action. But it's a little bit more vague, or when you look more towards like your overall arching goals, and some of the goals are to get rid of American democracy, for example, to establish things such as like anarcho-syndicalism or just straight out like socialism.
Get rid of American democracy and replace it with what?
With anarcho-syndicalism, typically, that's the most common answer you'll get. What? There's some Antifa groups that are more communism.
What is that? That word that you're using? Sure. What form of government is that?
It's a political theory that basically believes in anarchism. So ergo, no leaders, no police officers, none of that stuff. But you have typically small businesses that are working at the very local level, and they're not owned by one person. They're typically owned by every single employee. And it's supposed to be like everybody kind of working together to make sure that society is running together.
It's dismantling our American capitalist system that most of us accept and go along with.
And one of the reasons that is because when you talk to an Antifa activist, you would think that Antifa means just fighting Nazis, fighting the KKK. But ever since the 1990s, the WTO protests, it's encompassed a lot more of that. They believe that in order to fight racism, well, you have to dismantle capitalism. In order to fight racism and fascists, you also have to fight against corporations destroying the earth. And those are some of the talking points that you'll be grilled on in multiple different conversations.
It seems like, too, they want to destroy police organizations.
Yeah. And as a matter of fact, when the whole defund the police movement came along a couple of years ago, there was an Antifa activist who was quoted in The New Yorker. The New Yorker asked him, okay, well, why are you trying to get rid of the police? And he said something along the lines of, well, it's getting us one step closer to anarchism, to getting rid of government at all. It's very incrementalism type thinking.
So the feelings of most of the public, which likes American capitalism, likes their life, likes having police protecting them, all that doesn't matter, that most of the public has no interest in what you're selling.
Yeah, pretty much. And I mean, I love what you just said. You know, we just received, we put out a polling survey at Our America, and we found out that 76% of Americans support the police. To Antifa, they don't care. They have a big megaphone and they're willing to use it. And one of the issues that often happens in political debates is that we're always arguing about very fringe issues that actually very few people support. Defunding the police is one of them. A lot of people don't love the police, yet somehow we're arguing about whether we defund them. Or like another one that I love is like Latinx. Latinx is not popular within Latino communities. 99% of Latinos reject Latinx, but somehow it's being forced down the throat of a lot of Americans. And one of the issues we've been seeing at Our America is that, or we're trying to combat, is those tiny radical minorities that seem to have a huge megaphone and they try to dictate American policy when they're not even that big.
Why does, in your opinion, the media amplify all of this? All these fringe issues. See, it's pounded into everyone's head all day by the media that these are important things, and
we have to change. And
that these are the proper opinions to have. When did the media join And why?
There's a few different reasons for this. One way is because controversy sells papers. If they are able to show this controversial issue, even though a minority of people believe, all of a sudden they're getting a lot of papers being sold. People are tuning in. But another reason why is because some of these radicals have, in fact, infiltrated some of these media institutions. I mean, let's just look at CNN, for example. For the last 6 years, or what is it now? Since 2015, that's 8 years now. Whew. Anyways, when Antifa really entered like the public domain and like it became kind of mainstream, you had a lot of people apologizing for Antifa. You had Mark Bray, who wrote the book Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook, going on and saying and downplaying Antifa and making it seem like it wasn't a big deal. And well, the majority of Americans, I believe, that are seeing right through that. So if you look at the coverage that CNN is pushing out now, they don't even mention Antifa. I have yet to find an article about Atlanta, Georgia, and the Treehouse Antifa, all of this that's happening right now, where they mention Antifa. The only time that they mention Antifa is whenever it is to try to dismiss conspiracy theories about January 6th, that Antifa isn't there.
So
it makes right-wingers look
there bad. Are enough people infiltrated the media and CNN that are sympathetic to Antifa that they'll go along with not putting the organization in a bad light.
Yeah, I'm not necessarily that they're members or they just don't want, they see them as very aligned with their causes. Maybe they may not like the tactics. They may seem that it's a little icky, but at least they have the heart in the right place. They're fighting the right fight or the right opponent. You know, so let's not go through that. That's kind of the general sense that I get from a lot of reporters that refuse to name Antifa by name, despite the fact that they're very open that they're the ones organizing this violence.
All right, can you hold on?
Sure.
All right. We're talking to Gabriel Nadalis. The book is Behind the Black Mask, My Time as an Antifa Activist. Yes, he did wear the black mask and he did engage in protests as part of the group, you want to call it, Antifa Anti-Fascist. But he changed his ways and he's talking about what it's like to be on the inside. More coming up. John and Ken, KFI AM 640 live everywhere, the iHeartRadio app.
You're listening to John and Ken on demand from KFI AM 640.
We continue with Gabriel Nadalis. He's got a book.
Yeah, Behind the Black Mask, My Time as an Antifa Activist. And he was a member, if you want to call it a member. That's something I wanted to ask about when we get him back on the air here.
Sure.
But I've always been curious. How organized is being part of Antifa? Do you guys have meetings? Do you have leaders? Do you just communicate on social media? How do you know what demonstration to go to? How does all this work? I never understood this.
I mean, it varies a lot where you're from. And just so your listeners know, I'm actually from the area. I'm from Azusa, California, so from the San Gabriel Valley. So my book talks about what I was doing in Los Angeles and Hollywood, all of those different things. So the best way to understand Antifa is to not see it as an organization, but as a movement. And within this movement, you have several different radical left-wing groups. Some of them call themselves Antifa, but a lot of them don't. Some of them will call the 161 crew, for example. That's what they call themselves in San Francisco. But the 161 crew actually stands for 1 is A, F is 6, and A is 1 is A again. 161 is anti-fascist action again. But it really depends. In Southern California, where I'm from, we had our own little collective, and we try to link up with some of the anarchist groups in Los Angeles, as well as like the Claremont and some of the groups that were going on there. As far as like meeting goes, it really depends. If you have some of the Anarchist Black Cross, for example, they'll have more official meetings, they'll have meetups and all that. But most of the time, you have very unofficial ways of recruiting. And modernly, they use a lot of social media. They'll put out a call to action in social media, and they'll just wait for people to answer. I think that's exactly what happened in Atlanta. Treehouse Antifa put out a call for violence. And all of a sudden, people from all around the country, they wanted to join in that action. So it's both very decentralized in the way that they work, but at the same time, at the local level, they are much more organized like a traditional organization.
I also understand that you do go to some college campuses to talk about, you know, what you saw as part of Antifa and what your life is like now, completely different.
Yeah, I mean, I've spoken to over 100 different college campuses. The last campus I spoke at, it was at Northern Arizona University, I believe it was. And, you know, I have the opportunity to talk to young students about what it means to wear the black mask, what I see, how I believe we can combat Antifa, as well as how warning them of just political extremism in general, because Antifa is not the only threat. It's one of the many threats that I see today in political extremism.
What kind of young person joins any of these Antifa groups? Is there a profile or several profiles you notice a certain kind of person showing up over and over again?
Well, it's actually a lot more diverse than people realize. There's people who come from nicer families, people who are immigrants, such as myself. I had a friend who came from a very dysfunctional family, and, you know, he joined because he thought he wanted to feel that community. But it's very diverse. You'll see people who, again, come from very good families, engaging in some actions that you would think, like, how you had a good upbringing.
Why do you think they do that? I mean, I just saw the other day that some of the people arrested in Atlanta were generally from more well-to-do families, educated families. What is the appeal of this for them, since they have been born more privileged than most?
Well, there's a lot of reasons for why they do it. One reason could be because they see themselves as having a duty to give back to the community. I know it sounds twisted that breaking windows is somehow giving back to your community, but they see themselves as, in a way, trying to save what they had, and maybe they don't deserve it. Maybe they want to make sure that everybody else has that same freedom that they do. But again, like, their vision for America is typically one of anarcho-syndicalism or anarchism.
And if you have anarchism, nobody's going to have a future, right? I mean, it's going to just be... What made you leave the organization?
Sure. I mean, I was sometime in my senior year of high school. I was already around them for about a year. And I remember I began to learn about Milton Friedman, Thomas Sowell, two great economists. And I remember just finding them very interesting at the time, but I didn't agree with them. So I wanted to talk about their ideas with my friends. Well, once I talked to my friends about it, well, they just called me a capitalist pig, and they would begin to ostracize me every time I brought up issues that, even though I didn't believe them, I just kind of wanted to play devil's advocate. And I started to realize that a lot of them just had a lot of bumper sticker ideologies. They didn't want to engage in discussion about these issues. So that made me want to go out and seek people who disagree with me. I've always kind of have an open mind, and I've always wanted to ask a lot of questions. Once in college, I started a libertarian group just because I wanted to talk to people who disagree with me. I wanted to explore ideas that I didn't have. And slowly and surely, I slowly started changing my beliefs. But let me tell you, a lot of people always ask me, what is it that changed? What flipped me? I never saw it as a flip. The way I saw my evolution, ideological evolution, was just that. It was an evolution, a slow transition. It's back now. Nowadays, I just can't even believe I was part of the anti-fascist movement. It was just a part of my life.
Are there many others like you, or are you an anomaly?
That I personally know and who grew up with me and did that? No. There is another guy. His name is Aaron, and he was involved in Texas, in the anti-fascist movement in Texas, a few years before me. I connected with him a few years ago. He wrote a book about the same subject. What is it called? It's called Black Bloc Anarchist, and has an amazing book. He has a very similar experience with me as mine of like becoming very disillusioned with people who didn't really want to discuss the problems. They just kind of wanted to attack people who disagree with them.
All right. Thank you very much for coming on the show. Again, the book is Behind the Black Mask. My time as an Antifa activist, Gabriel Nadalis. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
All right. We got more coming up. This is the John and Ken Show on KFI AM 640 live everywhere, the iHeartRadio app.
More Than a Movie is back with season 2 of the award-winning film podcast, and this time with a lot more movies. I'm your host, Alex Fumero, and each week I'm going to talk to the people behind some of my favorite movies. From The Godfather, Andy Garcia.
He has the smarts of Vito, the temper of Sonny, the warmth of Fredo, and the coldness of Michael.
To the OG spy kid, Alexa Penavega.
You had Carlo Gugino, who's the coolest mom ever. You had Antonio, who's handsome, amazing, charismatic. And then Carmen and Juni. I felt like a lot of other kids felt like this could be me.
to the legend behind La Bamba, Lou Diamond Phillips.
When I walked in, I didn't think I had a shot at Richie because John Stamos's picture was already up on the wall.
Every episode will feature interviews with the biggest actors, directors, writers, and producers behind your favorite films and tap into the history of Latinos in film. Listen to More Than a Movie as part of the My Cultura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Michael Rappaport.
And I'm Kibi Rappaport.
And together we're hosting Rappaport's Reality Podcast.
We have a passion for reality TV, and we're inviting you into our living room.
We're talking tea, we're dissecting the drama, and we're giving praise to the single greatest form of entertainment on television today. That is right. Reality TV is the greatest form of entertainment on television today.
Here are some examples of what you'll hear from us on Rappaport's Reality Podcast.
This is where we discuss all things reality TV, all things popular culture.
And a little bit of Rappaport's reality, the reality of us.
We're figuring out. And if we had been recording these last 4 or 5 days, it would have been,
the
podcast would have taken a left turn. Listen to Rappaport's Reality with me, Michael Rappaport, and my wife, Kibi Rappaport, starting May 8th on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to John and Ken on demand from KFI AM 640.
All right, so now we're going to talk about the race for president. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis apparently has been forming a coalition of sheriffs to address the border crisis. And it says here 90 law enforcement officials from across the country signed on to a letter released by DeSantis's gubernatorial office voicing support for his stance on border security. At least somebody's talking about the border, right? You'd wish Trump would, but all he wants to talk about is losing the election and, of course, all the charges against him. Anyway, one of those sheriffs is the Riverside County Sheriff, Chad Bianco, who's going to join us now to talk about this, because clearly the Times ran a story on this, and there's many immigration groups very, very upset with this decision. So let's bring on Sheriff Bianco and talk about it. Welcome to the John and Ken Show.
Thank you. I appreciate being on. Thanks.
All right. So what is this about? What is exactly this coalition of sheriffs to address the border crisis, the whole thing about?
I mean, all you have to do is read the letter. I mean, it really boils down to common sense and reason and actually thinking about something rather than just being told what to say. But we all know, all law enforcement knows, that what we have at the border right now is a disaster. And these, what's happening with these immigrant groups and civil rights, the ACLU, which is a complete, that's a joke of another story. They want to make it something that it's not. And the reality for law enforcement is the increase, the overwhelming increase of drugs being brought into the country, the gangs that are controlling human trafficking, the cartels controlling human trafficking is a crisis. And we are dealing with it on a day-to-day basis. So to actually have someone on a national platform come out and say, I want you to join my stance in taking care of our border and helping with crime and security, it's pretty much common sense. But the rest of these people want to make it political or whatever it is. And I even made the comment the other day that if our president would come out and say, I want all these sheriffs to join me in my fight to secure our border and stop the drugs and the gangs from coming across, we'd join his coalition too. But that's never going to happen.
Yeah, no. I mean, and really under discussed in all this, clearly there was a lot of coverage last month when Title 42 was ending about the great migrant rush into the United States, and that is an issue. But the whole drug thing, the fentanyl, and so many Americans that are dying from fentanyl poisoning is so undercovered and underplayed, and it's become a major, major problem at the border. And you barely hear the Biden administration and that the goofball that runs DHS, Mayorkas, say anything about this. They don't seem to be doing anything to stop. It says in there the story that DeSantis actually favors maybe the death penalty for drug cartel dealer leaders.
Yeah, and I did hear that. I've never read that. I did hear it, though, especially after the coverage from yesterday and all these people freaking out over what should be a common sense issue of fighting crime in our communities. But regardless of all of that, it's common sense. It's doing the right thing. It's protecting victims.
Yeah, exactly. It's what it's doing. It's protecting victims. What do you see in your county? It says here you did visit the border in Imperial County recently. What do you see in Riverside County as the biggest problems dealing with the open border?
Well, regardless of, and this is another thing of what these activists that want to make it an issue that's not an issue. They want to paint me as a racist or anti-immigration or whatever they want to say. The reality is I'm completely against crime. I do not like criminals. I am biased against criminals. I don't like crime. I want to keep us as safe as possible. And the truth of our border is from the day this presidential administration took office and opened the border, we have seen a substantial multifold increase in drugs coming across the border, in money and drugs being smuggled back into the country, and human trafficking, whether it's sex trafficking or labor trafficking. And that affects all of law enforcement on a day-to-day basis. But no one wants to talk about that. If we bring up the border and crime coming across, the cartels controlling who comes across and everything else and the drugs, we're just labeled as racist because no one wants to deal with the real issue of criminality and drugs and how we're going to keep us safe. We just paint everything with a Democrat or a Republican, and we label people that disagree with us as racist, and we hope that that emotional argument overrides the issue that they just don't want. They want drugs and alcohol or drugs into our country. They want criminals to have free reign in our country. And really, we don't know why. And we don't address that because we're fighting over racism issues.
Yes, exactly. And of course, all the uproar over the migrant flights, flying migrants to places like California, by Florida and by Texas. I mean, what's your reaction to all of that? Isn't that a rational way to say, let's spread out the problem? We're not a sanctuary state or a sanctuary city. We have too many migrants who have come here from foreign countries. We can't handle this in our state. You need to spread them out. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But of course, this has been turned into another uproar, and you're right, claims of racism.
Yeah, and let me tell you the hypocrisy of that. We have between San Bernardino, Riverside, and Orange County, San Diego, and Riverside County. The state has sent over 100,000 immigrants to other states. Why is no one asking Governor Newsom about that? It's his funding. He's doing it. He's arranging it. But yet he's calling out governors from other states for sending them to California. There is no bigger hypocrite than our governor, and no one is calling him out on it, and no one is making him answer those questions. It's when you get to that level where everyone's making things about politics, all of them are a joke, and they need to go away. We need to stop voting for these people and make them go away.
You're saying that California sent 100,000 migrants to other states?
At least.
And where do you get that information from?
Those are our numbers. They're being dropped off in Riverside County, San Bernardino, or Riverside County, San Diego County, and Orange County. We have to handle them. We have to process them. Our medical our Department of Health, County Department of Health, has to make sure they're taken care of medically, physically. We house them in hotels if our NGOs don't have room, and then we figure out where they're going to go or where they want to go, and then we pay for them to get there. The state is paying millions and millions of dollars to send these people that are coming across illegally to other states. But yet our failure of a governor wants to accuse other people of doing it so he can get a few media spots for his God forbid run for president.
Yeah, that may be what we're looking at eventually someday, if not next year, in 2028. What do you think of the presidential campaign? So does this mean that you're endorsing Ron DeSantis, and you think he has the best answers for the border problems?
No, it means that at all. It goes back to what I said earlier. If President Biden would come up with something like that, I'd jump on board with it. If you change the DeSantis name to Biden, I would jump on board with that also. And if Trump said something, or if Kennedy said something, I would be fully on board, because this isn't about politics. When you're talking about law enforcement and public safety, it's not about politics. It's right versus wrong. It's black versus white. And it's what are we doing to better make our communities safer? And if we're failing, we have to do something different. And if someone has a better way of doing it or a better plan, I'm all for it.
Yeah, I mean, the other side likes to call the migrant crisis a humanitarian crisis. And, you know, you can make an argument that people are looking for an escape from their home country. But the drug part, I'm talking to Riverside County Sheriff Chad Bianco, the whole idea of getting all these drugs into the country, particularly now with the fentanyl problem, you would think they would be doing everything they could to stop this from happening. And one of my theories is that it's such a big moneymaker for Mexico. The Mexican government is not interested in stopping the cartels.
Yeah, probably not. And we all know it, through history, we know that the cartels have a major, major, major influence in the politics in Mexico. So you're exactly right with that. But here it's just all about politics. It's how can we use a catastrophe, or how can we use an emergency for our own benefit, and we'll twist it around and call it something that it's not, and we'll try and benefit from it politically. And it flies in the face of public safety, which is why no politician is going to debate a law enforcement officer about public safety, because, to be quite honest, the ones that we have, and especially the leaders we have, they don't care.
All right, Sheriff Chad Bianco, thanks for talking to me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. You're welcome. Anytime.
All right. Riverside County Sheriff Chad Bianco. And of course, he's in the news because he's joined a coalition of sheriffs from around the country to address the border crisis. This is coming from the Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and his campaign for president. And they want to try to work on solutions to not only the migrant problem, but of course, the drug problem. John and Ken, KFI, AM 640, live everywhere, the iHeartRadio app.
You're listening to John and Ken on demand from KFI AM 640.
It's become the hot new topic, getting rid of your gas stove. The climate fanatics, of course, spent a lot of years trying to get you out of your car. Well, they probably hit a bump there that they can't quite get over right now, although they're coming up with ideas like mileage taxes, which they keep pushing. But so the next thing that they're thinking about is the gas stove. Well, there's an offshoot to this story, and it's going to take us to New York City. And it involves probably one of the most treasured, precious food items for New York City people who live there and visit there, and that's the pizza. And the war there concerns the coal and the wood-fired ovens that make the pizza. That's what makes the pizza the best. Anybody who professionally cooks pizza can tell you, or bakes it, can tell you it is critical that you have just the right oven to cook the dough and the ingredients. Well, New York City is coming after coal and wood-fired ovens, and it's got the pizza people really worked up. The New York City Department of Environmental Protection has drafted new rules that would order these pizza places using these decades-old baking method to slice carbon emissions by up to 75%. The statement from one of their spokesholes, Ted Timbers, is all New Yorkers deserve to breathe healthy air, and wood and coal-fired stoves are among the largest contributors of harmful pollutants in neighborhoods with poor air quality. Oh, they've got to be kidding me. This is very similar to the gas stove argument. This common sense rule, developed with restaurant and environmental justice groups, there's the key words, environmental justice groups, requires a professional review of whether installing emissions controls is feasible. So the rule would require pizzerias with ovens installed prior to May of 2016 to buy emission control devices. The owner of one Brooklyn pizza place says he's already thrown out $20,000 on an air filter system in anticipation of the new mandate. Others are saying this is just too much money for us to spend on pollution control equipment for something as, I mean, they're coming after pizza in New York City, trying to slash carbon emissions from wood and coal-fired stoves. Unbelievable. We have some audio. We're actually going to begin. I did see this guy's gone kind of viral. It's a conservative man who lives in New York City. It's like being a conservative guy in San Francisco. His name is Scott Lobato, and he made the news because he took his protest right to New York City City Hall. And he started tossing pizzas over the fence at City Hall. And here is part of his rant.
The woke idiots who run this city are doing everything in their power to destroy it. We have naked men with their bouncing around all over the city yesterday in public in front of children. We have the most violent, raging crime rate ever. We are being invaded by illegal immigrants who are being treated way better than our homeless veterans, our teachers, and first responder heroes who were fired, still not compensated, because they didn't take the Fauci injection. Our city schools produce the dumbest kids, and the woke punks who run New York City are afraid of pizza. The world used to respect New Yorkers as tough, thick-skinned, and gritty. Now we have become fight. It's a damn shame. You heard of the Boston Tea Party? Well, this is the Boston, New York. This is the New York Pizza Party. Give us pizza or give us death. Give us pizza or give us death.
No.
Give us pizza or give us death.
There's the chant.
Give us pizza.
Or give us pizza or give us death. Well, he put everything in there in the revolution against the woke.
That's what this city keeps doing. Can't have a small business. Can't have pizza. New York City is nothing without pizza. The Boston Tea Party, this is the New York Pizza Party. Gotta do my thing, man.
Now, a city official said that under 100 restaurants would be impacted. A pizza restaurateur told the New York Post that there are negotiations underway with the Department of Environmental Protection to maybe grandfather in or exempt dozens of coal and wood-fired pizza joints from the mandate. I mean, I went out to a pretty really good pizza place, and you know it's a good place that takes it very seriously because the menu has all the different kinds of pizza that you can get, Chicago-style or Detroit-style or New York, and it's different ovens the way they do this, because it's a whole different technique. This restaurateur said, this is an unfunded mandate. It's going to cost us a fortune, not to mention ruining the taste of the pizza, which could totally destroy the product. He said, if you bleep around with the temperature in the oven, you're going to change the taste. That pipe, that chimney, it's that size to create the perfect updraft. It keeps the temperature perfect. It's an art as much as a science. You take away the char, the thing that makes the pizza taste great, you kill the whole thing. And for what? You really think you're changing the environment with these 8 or 9 pizza ovens? That's, of course, the overriding point. I mean, the madness that has infected California has made its way to many other states, including New York City, where now they're worried about emissions from pizza ovens. You have got to be kidding me. He's exactly right. And again, the total emissions of California, New York together is a fraction of the world's emissions. This is absolutely incredible. One other resident said, just tell Al Gore to take one less private jet or something like that. Give me a break. This is hard to believe. And an owner of another pizza place says the air scrubbers, he doesn't think, will affect the quality of the taste or the texture of the pies. If someone is trying to say that putting the scrubber in changes the flavor of the pizza, well, they're trying to save themselves $20,000. But $20,000 is a lot of money for a small business to afford. Some of these businesses, particularly how badly they got hit by the whole pandemic and the lockdowns from a couple of years back, are still struggling to recover. And you're going to come after them over their wood and coal-fired pizza oven emissions? Unbelievable. All right, John and Ken, KFI, AM 640, live everywhere, the iHeartRadio app. Hey, you've been listening to the John and Ken Show. You can always hear us live on KFI AM 640, 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. every Monday through Friday, and of course, anytime on demand on the iHeartRadio app.
I'm Diosa.
And I'm Mala.
We are the creators of Locatora Radio, a radiophonic novela, which is a fancy way of saying
a podcast. Welcome to Locatora Radio Season 9.
Love at first listen.
This season, we're falling in love with podcasting all over again.
With new segments, correspondence, and a new sound.
Listen to Locatora Radio as part of the Michael Dura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
More Than a Movie is back with Season 2. I'm your host, Alex Fumero. And each week, I'm going to talk to the people behind your favorite movies. From The Godfather, Andy Garcia.
He has the smarts of Vito, the temper of Sonny, the warmth of Fredo, and the coldness of Michael.
To the legend behind La Bamba, Lou Diamond Phillips.
When I walked in, I didn't think I had a shot at Richie because John Stamos's picture was already up on the wall.
Listen to More Than a Movie on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Michael Rappaport.
And I'm Kibi Rappaport.
And together we're hosting Rappaport's Reality Podcast.
We have a passion for reality TV, and we're inviting you into our living room.
We're dissecting the drama, and we're giving praise to the single greatest form of entertainment on television today. That is right. Reality TV is the greatest form of entertainment on television today. Listen to Rappaport's Reality starting May 8th on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.